Welcome back to the Preacher Podcast. We are concluding our series today called The Need for Followership. Today, followers of Christ make selfless sacrifices. With me today, as they've been throughout this series, Pastor John Veiths of Grace in Norman, Oklahoma, and Pastor John Calpine of Calvary in Dallas, Texas. Also with us today, Pastor Jim Tiefel from Trinity and St. John's in Mequon, Wisconsin. And I'm John Mitchell from Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary. John Calpine, could you tell us a bit about the theme of the day in this worship series that we're concluding today?
Yeah, as you've mentioned, it concludes a series really on the various aspects of the Christian life under the theme, A Need for Followership, and how do followers of Christ live. And it's maybe one of the broader of the themes. Really gets at some of the essence of a life of followership, and that is that it's not about us, but about others. So the need for selfless sacrifice serves as a theme for the broader readings.
Excellent. Yeah, just it is a broad series, but we've had the opportunity, I think, to address in these past several weeks just a lot of big topics that relate to the Christian life, which of course is very appropriate for this season after Pentecost, when we're listening to Jesus and following through on his words. John Veiths, could you tell us a little bit about the gospel and the first reading today before we get to the second reading for our text?
Yeah, so the second lesson today is the text we're choosing to discuss for sermon work, and 1 Corinthians 9, the Apostle Paul's discussion there. The idea of selfless sacrifice runs through the lessons. The gospel lesson is maybe the point of departure with the idea of Christ's sacrifice, because as Jesus was settling the argument that arose among the disciples after James and John go to him and ask for his position, for their positions at his right and left, the group of disciples is angered about that. And probably because they didn't think of it first. And so he has to walk them through this idea that the believer, the disciple, is not about seeking position for himself, but what makes one great in the kingdom of God is a matter of selfless service, becomes a slave of all, a servant to all. And then at the end of that, Jesus lays down the example of his own reason for being there. The Son of Man did not come to serve, but to be served, give his life as a ransom. The Isaiah text, which is lined up with it, is maybe a bit of a surprise in that, in its context, we're thinking of Isaiah chapter 53 with Lent and Good Friday. But there you have described in a little more detail the sacrifice that Jesus did make, that God's will for his life was that he make his life a guilt offering, that was God's plan for him, not to simply look out for himself in this world. In the text that we're going to look at, the Apostle Paul talks a little bit about his own remuneration and both spiritual and earthly. And of course, in the Isaiah text, you do have this idea of the Lord giving the Messiah a portion and dividing the spoils. You can't draw direct lines there, but maybe some thematic ideas that are hinted at a bit in that text. So it helps to unify the three. But that's the gospel and the Old Testament lesson, the first lesson that bookend our sermon text for the day.
Okay, well, let's go to that text then. Jim, could you get us started as we discuss preaching 1 Corinthians 9, 7 to 12, and then 19 to 23?
I think it's kind of important that you really take a close look at both chapters 8 and 9. Because in both chapters, Paul is setting down a principle that words and actions toward others often impact the faith of others, and that Christian love has to sometimes set aside freedom for the sake of the faith of others. And then he uses two examples. In chapter 8, he uses the example of eating meat sacrificed to idols. And then in chapter 9, He uses the example of financial support for his ministry. And both sections lay down the same principle. And there are some passages in 8 that I think could be used to support some of the points made by the text. As far as the proposal of the text is concerned, and some of you maybe still remember the old homiletics statement, the proposition, the textual proposition. The text proposes that love for the lost and the found leads Christians to imitate Paul in their willingness to set aside their Christian freedom for the sake of the faith of others. That seems to be the main point in this. And of course, when they imitate Paul, they're also imitating Jesus, who did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for all. And that's in the gospel. As far as a malady is concerned, what you want to identify as a sin, while insisting that sometimes you have to demonstrate and you have to stand up for Christian freedom. Like when somebody accuses you of something which the Bible does not call a sin, there are times when you have to stand up and say, I'm going to, you know, the old story of Erhard Panko, when the lady told him that she wasn't going to come to his church services anymore because he was leading the hymns with his violin. And he tried to talk her out of it, but she wouldn't back down. And then, of course, the tagline is, and so he picked up his fiddle and he played it. I mean, there are times when you have to do that. But such insistence may also be the voice of the sinful nature, which ignores the importance of the faith of brothers and sisters and the impact that your freedom determination is going to have on their faith. In 8:12, Paul said, when you sin against them in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. So there definitely can be a sin here with the insistence upon freedom. The goal of the sermon, or what some of you may still call the telic note, the goal of the sermon is to lead believers to examine the activities of their freedom, take a look at what they do, and then to remove roadblocks which may harm the sharing of the gospel. A sermon on this text is really not going to be primarily a sermon on the saving service of Christ, which is what you would get if you would preach on Isaiah. But it really is going to be on the service that the Christian extends in response to the service of Christ. As far as law gospel emphases are concerned, I could see preaching the law in this text in its first use by pointing out how often we overlook the necessity of faith in the lives of others. It happens too many times that in our assessment of friends and relatives and acquaintances and neighbors, we don't think so much about the importance of faith in Christ in their lives. We think about other things in our relationship with them. And that's a sin, not to consider the necessity of faith in people's lives. And then also how often we fail to modify words and actions with the faith of others in mind, that we don't stop and think what our actions, what effect our actions or our words are having on the faith of others. We blurt out something or we say something and we don't think how that's going to affect other people's faith. Paul had every right to use his freedom to accept financial support, but he chose not to, so that no one would think that he was preaching for personal gain, and we often fail to follow that example. I think that law can be preached in its first use. The law can be preached in its third use by pointing out how Paul treated various people in various ways and then to give examples. I think that section where he talks about how he acted in this case and how he acted in that case can certainly give examples of how it's always a person-to-person thing. You're dealing with individuals. What one person finds problematic, another person doesn't find problematic. Paul sometimes preached differently in a synagogue in a Jewish city than he preached in a synagogue in a Gentile city. The gospel content, I don't think there's any in this text. The gospel content comes primarily from the day's gospel and from the first reading. And I think you have to find a way to work that in. And the suggestion that I'm going to give for a summary of this text has a way to work that in. I think that you have to be careful that you don't turn this into a Bible class on Christian freedom or on adiaphora. There are lots of ways that, especially the second section of the text, I've become all things to all men. There's lots of areas in which that works, and you have to keep this. You have to keep this from becoming a conference paper, and make sure that it's a sermon. As far as an outline, I thought I would start by talking about how I deal with my dad and his favorite team when I've decided I'm not going to root for his favorite team anymore. Or what I'm going to finally say when I tell my mom, you know, I never did like that tuna casserole that you made. Or how I'm going to react to my brother and his perennially messy room. Or how I'm going to think about my sister and the boyfriend I don't really like. None of those things really has to do with faith. And I don't have to be so concerned when I tell my dad, Dad, I'm not going to be a Bears fan anymore. But all of a sudden, I have to think about, my dad and I enjoy a beer, but I notice that he has too many of them. Or my mom is worried that by taking a job in a new city, I'm not going to go to church anymore. Or when I put up my sports awards in my bedroom, my brother gets jealous and resentful because of what I do. Now all of a sudden faith is involved because my actions, my reaction to my dad, my reaction to my mom, my reaction to my brother, all of those might entail me to have to give up some of my freedoms. So that the theme that I came up with, and there are certainly other ways to attack this, how do we love when faith is at stake? How do we love when faith is at stake? Mm-hmm. And there are basically three main points. Think about faith, think about freedom, and then think about forgiveness. If you want to take a break here and have the other guys react to this, I'm willing to talk a little bit more about how I would attach the text of each of those three areas, but I can wait with that.
Okay, let's do that. John, your thoughts on what Jim has presented here. Let's just start with kind of the overall summary and goal of the text. What is the aim of your sermon on a text like this? Is it kind of encouragement in the realm of Christian living, principles behind that, and how that, you know, how that looks in everyday lives, something to that effect? Your reactions there to Jim's identification of the kind of the proposal and the goal of the text. John Vies, can we start with you?
Yeah, so I would agree that if you're going to apply this to the general Christian in the pew, understanding what Jim said about chapter 8, being in view for this whole thing, that, you know, the Apostle Paul is essentially using his ministry as an illustration of the principle that he was trying to explain in chapter 8. You know, the chapter 9 marker that we have in our Bibles was not in the original text. And if you read through chapter 8, it flows right here into chapter 9, where Paul is talking. So I think that's a good connection for taking this and not just making it about the rights of a person in the ministry and how they may or may not use it. But I think the other thing you could do would be, since Paul does take such a deep dive on that, you could use that as an opportunity to talk about that relationship of pastor and congregation and such. You kind of have to make a call on what direction you want to go with the text, and I suppose your local situation and what your people are dealing with will direct you in whether it's a little bit more general than what Paul's talking about in your application to the people, or whether you're going to talk about various applications for the pastor. That second idea is least comfortable for us, I suppose, because to get up in front of our people and talk about that is it's a bit awkward, but in certain cases I could see where it might be useful in a congregation.
Great. Can I just pause there? Jim, did you have a thought in response to that?
Yeah, I agree with you, John. I guess if I were to tackle that, I would probably prefer to tackle it in a Bible class, where you can kind of expand your thinking and expand your thoughts, rather than try to, you know, bring the pastor in. You don't give them a chance to disagree when you're in the pulpit or when you're walking around in front of the church like most guys are doing these days. But I digress. So
yeah. Well, and yeah, that's right. So I think it's an awkward sermon to preach in some ways. You would have to be even-handed, right? You got to police yourself and talk about issues on both sides. You know, on the one hand, that the congregation support a pastor, but I think there's often opportunity to talk about what we all know about, and that is all the scandals that have been in the ministry in the general Christian world because of pastors who are too concerned about the money side of things, and maybe a little personal confession about the pastor's own struggle with that as he balances his need to be supported for his gospel work with the temptations that those things offer also.
Okay. Yeah, John Kelpine, just thoughts in reaction to that.
Yeah, there's the lectionary gives you some direction, so you're probably wanting to focus a little bit more on the selfless sacrifice rather than the relationship between pastor and people. I think what Jim has said, maybe a little bit more colloquially, it's about rights and freedoms, and an emphasis here also on the right not to, and also the freedom not to. So rights and freedoms often posed in a positive way. I have the right to do this. I have the freedom to do this. Certainly in our country, that takes a prime spot. And here Paul is putting the brakes on and saying that those rights and freedoms also come with the right and freedom not to, understanding the circumstance that Jim so accurately talked about. How is my exercise or lack thereof or waiving my rights affecting the faith of others?
Right. Yeah, then to kind of law and gospel thoughts, Jim had mentioned several ways to approach that. John Veith, some thoughts on that?
So it was a pretty thorough covering of it. I think it's just a striking thing and bears some repeating, that as the Apostle Paul is walking us through this idea of our rights, those are God-given. They are blessings and gifts and need to be considered such. But we can actually turn even that blessing of God into an idol when we raise it in our estimation to such a point that we would not be concerned about the salvation and or just spiritual welfare of our brother or sister more, right? That's a striking thought, I think.
I think there's sometimes people hide behind, well, it's the principle of the thing, and I want to hold on to the principle, which may have some reason sometimes. But I think some of the law here, too, is otherwise stated, it's just a selfish demanding of my rights, which Paul is arguing against. When it affects my brother, sister in the faith, negatively, when it affects my opportunity to share, it's a selfish thing then to demand that I have my right or I have my freedom to do this.
Right. Jim?
I think one of the things that has been most frustrating for me getting back into parish ministry again and actually seeing people in their interaction with family members, especially sons and daughters, there is a tendency to see them as no more than a son or a daughter, are no more than a coworker or no more than a friend, rather than seeing them as a potential or an existing child of God. They tend to keep that out of the mix, and they get along fine when they see each other, but they never want to risk the confrontation of why do you insist on living with your girlfriend? Why do you not come to church on Sundays? So they forget that whole faith concept of these people that they love. And then, of course, that enters into this picture of how do I live my life now so that that faith construct is not wounded, is not harmed. And I think sometimes from the pulpit, you got to say that to them right between the eyeballs, because they don't like to hear that.
Right. Yeah. Sacrificing my own comfort for the sake of the gospel or the people with whom I have the opportunity to speak the gospel. Right. So Jim mentioned the challenge here of the gospel itself in this sermon, or how we express that, since it is a sanctification-oriented text, an encouragement to, you know, live out our righteousness by making selfless sacrifices. So, John and John, I'd interested to hear your thoughts. How do you approach the gospel, preaching the gospel from this text? Did you go, as Jim suggested, maybe to Mark 10 and Isaiah 53 and work with that, or something, a different approach? John Kelpin, could we start with you?
Sure. Yeah, you have to bring it in. If verse 19 or 18 rather was included in the text, Paul's pretty clearly expressing the gospel. What is my reward then, that I preach the gospel and do it without charge? Paul's, this is what he wants to do. He wants to preach the forgiveness of sins, wants to preach God's mercy. That gives you a nice window and a nice avenue. But ultimately, yeah, it is the example. It is the actual self-sacrifice of Christ that overcomes my sin and my selfishness. Why would I want to regard the faith of my neighbor and my children and my family? Because I deeply desire for them to have the salvation that I know Christ has won for me. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, too, that gospel is what gives me the freedom and the right to sometimes say no to things that I might otherwise have the right and the freedom to say yes to, because of that. I know that's what Christ did for me, and that mercy motivates me to live that life.
Yeah. John Vietz?
Maybe some implicit rather than explicit things in the text itself. John Jeske used to use the illustration of the gospel being like a jewel with multifacets. And the very rights, the very freedoms, the status that we have that allows us to have those things is itself a gospel thing. It grows out of our justification. It isn't the justification itself. It's not the forgiveness of sins per se, but it is related there, right? That's why I have these freedoms. The gospel has set me free to have these freedoms that Paul is defending, and the rights. The concern for the Jewish person on the one hand, or for the pagan on the other, or for the weak brother on the other hand, again, this is implicit, it's indirect, it's not explicit, but there is some touching of the blessing of the communion of saints. You know, Paul is really concerned about saving other people, and in having other believers around me, that I'm not alone in my Christian walk in life. Again, it's not direct at all, but a person could perhaps touch upon that. And then his statement at the end about so that I myself, you know, may share in its in the gospel's blessings in verse 23. How did he say that exactly? So that I may be a partaker of it or share in it. Okay, so he's hinting at where the gospel leads for oneself, and it's not direct, but if you are looking for places to talk about it anyway, you could flesh that out for the listener.
Yeah. Jim?
Yeah, I've talked a lot and written a lot, even in Preach the Word, about preaching on the alternate readings in light of the day's gospel. And I just always look for ways to tie the other readings to the day's gospel specifically, and to pass by Jesus' third prediction of his suffering and death, and to pass by the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. I don't want to give that up. And so I agree totally that there is some gospel that can be found in this text, but to tie the second reading with the day's gospel would be a priority for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's such beautiful gospel. Paul's a great example of giving up freedoms and rights, but he pales even comparison to Christ, who had a right to give us what we deserved, which was the wrath and punishment we had coming, a right to stay in heaven and continue in his relationship there in heaven. He had a right to say to those who falsely accused him, "You guys are wrong, and I'm innocent." And in freedom, he came to serve. The King of creation comes to serve. That, and it means the gospel. Mm-hmm. Paul means he's a nice guy. Jesus does it, and it means we're forgiven.
Yeah. There's also, you know, this great freedom. Paul mentions that explicitly in the text here. That is a fruit of the gospel. My salvation doesn't depend on what I do or don't do, what I have or don't have. Christ has set me free, or I'm not obligated to do certain things in order to get into his good graces. That's taken care of by Jesus. And there's a security that comes from that too. You know, so I can live without something that I might have the right to enjoy. And, you know, I'll be fine because I'm okay in Christ to make that sacrifice. I don't have to hold on to it for dear life because Christ has given me the security that I need to make those sacrifices. So that, yeah, I mean, we're all talking about the relationship of the gospel to the fruit that Paul speaks of in the text here. But there's beautiful correspondence here. And I like the idea of looking back to those famous words in Mark 10 and Isaiah 53 too, to just bring that out explicitly.
I think because there is such a, I'd say it's a fairly tight connection between how Paul talks about giving up his freedoms to serve these people towards their salvation, mm-hmm. and what Jesus is dealing with in the gospel lesson. It's a fairly natural connection there. It's not, you're not dragging that in kicking or screaming. No. And as much as that gospel text, as Jim pointed out, is just, it's hard to avoid. I think at the same time, it's also very easy to import here.
Yeah, I think so. It just a natural connection. His willingness to serve us just flows into our willingness to serve in grateful response to that too. Jim mentioned earlier some application thoughts, kind of as he talked about the kind of the framing of the sermon, being concerned about the faith of others and proclaiming the gospel to them. Is that kind of, John and John, ideas you would have for applications? So we mentioned this a little bit already, but kind of in the realm of people's personal relationships with one another and wanting to put up no obstacles to the sharing of the gospel. Other ideas for application thoughts there?
You know, when you think about the applications here, I think Jim gave us personal examples. And I think if some of the applications are going to be pointed and contemporary, they probably have to be personal. You don't want to call out anybody or any situation that you've dealt with in the ministry that somebody might know or realize. I think you're pretty good just staying with some of the things that Paul did. Paul gives examples in a broad way, and you can think of some specific examples of what happened in Paul's. Otherwise, you're going to preach for a long time trying to come up with examples one after the other. so that it's, it won't be difficult for people to think of, especially with a theme crafted like Jim has it, thinking of how do I live my life thinking about the faith of others? Giving some broad principles will lead them to be making those applications pretty quickly.
Right. Jim, thought in response?
Yeah, to that. I think, you know, if you begin with, think about faith, I don't think this text can be preached analytically, by the way. I think you have to, you know, you have to move some things around, but you notice how strong Paul feels about preserving the faith of the people around him. Faith is a big deal. He doesn't want to hinder the gospel. He wants to win as many as possible. He prays that at least some might be saved. And I think to address a congregation and encourage them to think of themselves as an instrument of the faith process, you know, that whole instrumental cause of salvation, that they are part of that. Mom teaches the little child how to pray. Dad supplies the example of how to worship, the way you raise your child. I mean, you think of yourself in this role as the instrument of sharing the gospel. I think they have to come to grips with that. When they think about this whole issue of freedom, that's what Paul is talking about in 7 to 11. He's got all of this freedom. He owns it. He has it. He has a right to it, not only by the world's wisdom, but even by God's wisdom. And we have that freedom too. I think it's a beautiful thought about how faith enables us to live in freedom from the curse of the law, but it can also become a roadblock. And sometimes that insistence on freedom can cause others to fall. So you develop that whole idea of what freedom can be, and what the positive aspects of freedom and the negative aspects of freedom. I was trying to think of that Luther quote that's on the Luther statue that John Calpine and I snuck out of class to watch being planted on the grounds of the seminary. A free Lord of, how does that go?
Yeah.
The question is the...
That's from the Freedom of the Christian Man, right? The Christian's a perfectly free Lord, subject to none. He's a perfectly dutiful servant, subject to all.
Yeah, right. That's the exact phrase. I think that would be a great quote in this sermon.
Yep.
Because both sides of it tells both sides of that.
Right. Right.
And then thinking about forgiveness, I think if you do some first use of the law preaching in part two, I think you move naturally into the sacrifice that Christ made in Mark 10, and how Paul lives that forgiveness. I like the translation of Hena Pontus Tenas Soso. Instead of, the NIV translates it by all possible means, I think it is better translated at least, so that at least some might be saved. I mean, there is only one means which affects Christian faith, and that's the means of grace. But Paul is he realizes what's out there in the world. He realizes people's actions. He realizes the temptation of the devil. And so I am willing to become all men, all things to all men, that at least some might be saved. I think that's the point that he wants to make there. And then simply give, in note, I think a point you can make is note the individuality, that I have to deal with each person as an individual. In some cases, giving up my freedom, and in some cases, not needing to give up my freedom. So there's just so many practical things in that forgiveness aspect that I think can be helpful to people as they deal with this issue.
I think that's one of the dangers of this text, that it could become the Bible class if I'm, you know, I end up with my list of 24 different things that I could talk about. And the thing, ears in the pew want to go, yeah, what about, what if, what if, what if, what if? And so to really discipline yourself to make sure that this is a sermon with homiletic value, and you're not going to be what if. that this text brings up.
And I mean, finally, the child of God has to make those decisions in his own individual life. You know, he has to just, if I'm dealing with a chronic alcoholic and I say, well, I'm not going to let that man's sin influence my enjoyment of liquor. I mean, you're not thinking at all of his faith in that situation. But to repeat the principle is better than repeating the specific illustration of it.
Right, hitting that the basic principle that Paul does here. We've touched on law, gospel, applications, purpose of the sermon. Any ideas for, I think, Jim, maybe you mentioned your theme already or a theme suggestion. Did you have a breakdown of kind of which verses you would treat in each part?
Well, like I said, I kind of moved things around. How do we love when faith is at stake? When I think about faith, which is the first point I wanted to make, there are passages in 12, 19, and 22 that deal with that. So you'd kind of grab them synthetically and point out Paul's concern. In the second part, think about freedom. There it's primarily 7 to 11, where he has that whole list of things that he has a right to do. He has a reference to freedom also in 21b that we may have freedom from the law, but in Christ, we also have the law. I mean, we have a desire in Christ to obey to obey what God says. And then in the third part, think about forgiveness. There you kind of start with Mark 10:45 and what that means, and then go into 20 to 23. So you kind of treat it analytically, but you also kind of treat it synthetically.
Yeah, grouping these.
I let a lot of things go in my sermons that I wouldn't let go in student sermons.
Right. Homiletics professors are above the law. I like.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Right, John Veith's. Any ideas for theme?
Well, part? Yeah. So kind of just I think the text does. There's a division. There's a two-part division in terms of emphasis, anyway. And depending on, I guess, how deep a dive you go into it, but something to the effect that Christians have rights too. People are very tuned into rights. I think in my lifetime, that has been something people have been concerned about in various ways. And as Americans, we're all concerned about our rights. And not that we make that what the sermon is about, but that maybe is illustrative information to introduce the thought. So
that would be very timely right now. That would be very timely right now.
Yeah.
And probably will be a year from now.
Well, it just keeps going, I think.
Yeah.
Christians have rights too. And then in the first part, kind of the rights defended, you know, Apostle Paul talks about what his rights are, and that there's both law and gospel to be talked about there, what the rights are, where they come from, that source. And then the second part, the rights relinquished, and there too, with there's both law and gospel to talk about with the what I do for my neighbor, but then also the saving goal of them. So something like that: rights defended, rights relinquished.
Good.
Yeah, John Kelpin, any ideas?
Yeah, there's so many paradoxes here, and that always. Yeah. Always intrigues me that the preaching and the paradox. So, well, I got a number of things, but one that, like, win by giving up. There's a whole lot of, you know, again, Paul, it's not the exercise of your, but it's more the non-exercise of your rights. So win by giving up your rights. That would be the first section. Giving up your privileges, the second section. Again, a paradox one. Sometimes no means yes to serve the gospel. No, I won't demand my rights. No, I won't demand my freedom in the hopes that I might save some, that emphasis on the faith of others. Or do what's right for faith, forego a right in service to the gospel, or engage what's right to win the gospel. So that kind of that, again, thinking about the rights, the freedom, which are so important to 21st century Americans, and it's right there in the text, rights and freedoms, and how that Paul is twisting it in a way the world wouldn't expect.
Great. Any concluding thoughts that we haven't had the opportunity to mention yet, or additional things for preachers to think about? Any last words we want to get in? Well, not seeing any. I just want to thank you, John Kelpien, John Veith, for these past several weeks of serving on the podcast. And Jim, thank you for being with us today. And preachers, God bless you as you encourage your listeners to follow Christ and open his beautiful words to them week by week throughout this series, and let the power of the gospel energize them as they do that very thing. God bless you, preachers.